I think it will be worthwhile starting today with a few minutes of meditation. Let us look carefully into whatsoever has hurt us most in life. Let us try and look at it with the mind in perfect equanimity. Select any one event in relationship with a person, or any one event which was concerned with a situation. It may be in connection with one's professional work or the unfulfillment of a great effort in life, ambition, or whatever it is. Or something which is intimate and personal to ourselves from within ourselves. One has sought something quietly, naturally, because it's natural for human beings to want to be happy, to be loved, to succeed in life, and so forth. And see with a very quiet mind just exactly what has hurt. And note the reactions from within one's own mind to that. Don't treat it as a case of digging up a morbid memory of the past or some such thing. Just utilize the memory of just what happened as a subject for careful examination. And particularly note how oneself today, at this moment, as one looks, reacts to that memory. We'll spend just about 5 minutes. Carefully consider some essential points in connection with such looking into the past. Did we notice, for instance, that there is a tendency to push it away out of consciousness? It's too unpleasant to think about. We have tried all these years to forget all about it. But we will find, if we look carefully, that we have never been able to forget it. And the effort to forget it only protracts the conflict. The state of confusion. It remains as a seed for sorrow, which sprouts out again and again. If we really saw that, we would also have seen, I mean saw that during these few minutes, we would also have seen that wisdom lies in facing it completely. Not facing it antagonistically. This is very important. Nor facing it with a kind of a diplomatic approach in order to come to a reasonable, amicable settlement. There is no such thing as a settlement with evil or with pain, with sorrow, with folly or whatever it is. No such thing. Or you may have noticed the tendency of the mind to want to know the reasons for it. Why did this happen to me? You may have noticed the tendency of the mind to soft pedal one's own foolishness or mistaken procedure in the whole situation, and to exaggerate the other person's fault, as we call it. But it's no good seeking for reasons in that manner. Because reasons are an organic part and parcel of the total fact. Reasons do not exist apart from the whole fact. The whole situation which hurt is composed of the other person or persons, of the particular circumstance, of oneself, and all the reasons, as we call them, which produced that hurt ultimately. And what we call the reasons that produced that hurt are what we call in Indian terms the karmic process. This is how the action proceeded. If we seek for reasons in the Kamana Garden way, what we are trying to do is to tear the reasons out of the whole context. We can do this intellectually, analytically. And what's the result? Just where does it take us when we have found out the reasons? Especially in our day and age, we have overemphasized, overvalued rationality and the place of reason, as we call it, in life. And amongst other things, we forget that our meaning of reason is an extremely limited meaning. It is restricted to whatsoever comes within the limited sphere of logical deduction, logical process. But all logical process in my brain is subject to my conditioning, to my own ignorance, my incapacity to see truth. Does that mean, therefore, that we must not seek to know reasons? Supposing we approach it this way, let us not seek to know the reasons. What we need to do is to see the fact as a whole, as something total. If we approach it fragmentarily, we will only get more fragments, more mess. If we approach it wanting to see the fact as a whole, and we can carry out this intense looking with the mind as quiet as possible, inactive in the ordinary sense of the term, then the reasons will reveal themselves. And you will find that when the reasons for a hurt, or for a pleasure if you like, lies both ways, you will find that when the reasons for a hurt reveal themselves in that way, they reveal themselves together with the healing process. Ordinarily, a person seeks the reason, and then he says, ah, I know the reason, now I can cure the ill. I can't, psychically, mentally. It's quite impossible to do that. Because this approach, I know the reasons, now I will apply the cure, is a case of conflict within myself. I'm going to attack the reason, I'm going to remove the reason. But look, what is the reason? What are the reasons? I'm going to formulate the question in a slightly different way. Who is the reason? I myself. This is the inescapable fact. I myself am the reason. In fact, such a big reason that all other little reasons that the logical intellect may throw up are all included in this one living source of reason, I myself. Now, if I attack myself to kill myself, what do I do? I don't heal myself yet. You see, we have to see this not merely with our intellectual side. The mind has to be so alert, so intense, so awake, that the whole being sees. It's as if not merely the brain saw, but the flesh and the blood and the bones and the skin and the hairs and everything saw. We have to see it that way. And you know, when we can begin to see it that way, we will begin to see something very, very wonderful. I myself am the reason, but who am I? William Brown? The organism named William Brown? Or Phyllis Mater? Or whatever the name is? Who am I? When one looks within like that and sees, begins to see oneself in totality, then this limited I ceases to exercise its illusion on my awareness. The illusion that this is me. I begin to see that it is, that there is only one meaning, only one real meaning to the word I. The meaning which comes out so beautifully in Exodus chapter 3 verse 14, where God says to Moses, I am who is, the one who is. And that is the only I that there is. The trouble is, once we hear this, read it, talk about it, it does not penetrate. This is the great difficulty in talking, in expanding. the very act of telling the other has spoilt it for the other. If I read the scripture, and because I've got a sharp intellect, I pierce through the veil at one point, and a piercing takes place only at one point, and the intellect immediately throws up a brilliant idea. Yes, oh, the eye represents the totality. It just remains at the top cortical layer and never penetrates inside. That is not whole seeing. But if, as a result, as the inevitable consequence of being intensely alert, quiet, passive, completely passive and watchful, this comes as a revelation, you suddenly say, of course, this is it. Then it is not merely that top cortical layer of the brain which has seen. This is realization of the truth. So now, I myself am the reason for that terrible hurt. But this I is actually the totality, the one total reality. That is the actual reason. Now, we must see the consequence of this. In the ordinary way, we talk about, I enjoyed this, I was in awful trouble over that. We talk about somebody, he is in terrible distress, in suffering, in pain, or there is, or so many Biafrans or Vietnamese or whatever it is, whoever they are in terrible pain. This person's pain and suffering, that person's pain and suffering, my pain and suffering. But if I really understand, as a matter of revelation, that I, the word I, means all mankind, means the totality, then there is no such thing in actual fact as merely my pain or your pain, my hurt or your hurt. There is only sorrow. You and I, with our eyes, can see only a little bit of the world at a time. With our minds, can penetrate into only a portion of the world. With the finest expansion of consciousness we may undergo, we can still sort of include, as far as we ourselves are concerned, just a portion of totality. Otherwise we'd be omniscient, wouldn't we? We don't know the totality, we don't see the totality. We see in terms of this man's pain, that child's pain, my pain, and so forth. But if we can experience this condition of revelation through the intensity of inward looking, then we become aware, although we won't see it as in a spatio-temporal sort of way, we will become aware that sorrow is sorrow. Now, if that awareness and the awareness that the word I stands for the totality is really intense, then all selfness, all self-orientedness in our approach to sorrow vanishes altogether. then sorrow, frustration, misery, hurt, pain is seen as a whole, the totality. All the world is in travail. All the world, without exception, is in travail. But look at this travail. This travail actually includes the opposites. My hurt, my delight. The world hurt, the world's delight. The two are completely included. Because only insofar as these duals are simultaneously operative, does the wheel of becoming keep turning. See, those of us, there are some of us here who are perhaps rather more deeply interested in Buddhism and the Buddhist presentation of things. If we don't understand this, we will never understand that first noble truth which the Buddha talked of, suffering, dukkha. It does not mean anything like what the vast mass of Buddhists think it means. And this world travail is not just a nice little intellectual presentation of a philosophical speculation or perception. It is a fact. This is the great difference between philosophy and religion. With the philosopher, it is always this intellectual aspect and presentation. With the religia, it is the personal awareness, the continual awareness. Your philosopher, having produced his system of philosophy, writes his book, gives it to the publisher, he's finished with it. Then he goes and hunts wild boar, perhaps. But he doesn't refrain from killing, which adds to the travail. But the religia lives differently because he has seen. The seeing of the religia is revelation, is transformation of his own being, which means the being of the world too, therefore. Because thou and I are not separate. But with the philosopher, he's produced a beautiful new dish for intellectual consumption, and he's finished with it. And he continues to inject what is unholy, insofar as he, like any one of us, has the unholy in him, into the turning of this wheel of becoming. Do we really see that? But if you really see that, you will have no perplexity anymore regarding the essential meaning of suffering, of sorrow, of evil. we will also see that there is no such thing as fighting against evil. Attempting to cure sorrow and supreme folly, trying to get rid of sorrow. The man of the world, the worldling, ignorant of inner reality, of inward truth, attempts all these things in the name of humanity, in the name of kindness, in the name of God, in the name of his brother man, and so forth and so forth. What does the religio do? The true religio refrains from engaging any activity which is a counterblast to any other activity which is around. He refrains from that, but that is merely one part of the story. What is the other part? He so lives that he transcends it. This is the point. Religion is concerned, I have said it, if I have said it once, I have said it 1,000 times during these years. Religion is concerned with transcendence. If we really have understood, really have seen the meaning of transcendence, our task is done, so to say. Because that real seeing means that one lives transcendently too. See, the deep implication of transcending, one is out of the realm of conflict. As long as one remains within the realm of conflict, one remains within the realm of ill, of evil. Consider one of the deep meanings of Jesus letting himself be crucified. He would not resist it. If he had sent out a contradictory force against those who were going to deprive him of his life, he would be just like one of them. Responding with an evil act. Or, actually, let me, not responding, reacting with an evil act. I first misused the word responding a few moments ago. To respond means that you are able to transcend. Therefore, there is a response. Where there is a real response, there is always a harmony. And as we have seen before, harmony does not reject discord and preserve only concord. It is the right sort of movement of the two together in relation to each other which makes for harmony. Harmony transcends the duals, discord and concord. So now, the religio is one who does not fight against evil. Does not fight against what hurt. We have on past occasions also through these years, now and again, looked, like we tried today, into what hurt us most. And I select this topic of what hurt us most because it is the most instructive topic as far as our own psychophysical individual existence is concerned. See, the natural urge of the organism is to want to get rid of pain, sorrow, dis-ease, the unpleasant. This wanting is the expression of the natural ignorance that afflicts us, an ignorance which is our heritage by virtue of possessing a physical body which is derived from the animal kingdom. The pleasure-pain interaction is indispensable for this animal body, for this animal body's survival. It is indispensable. If we didn't have this pleasure-pain interaction and we were unaware of it, the body would, if it ever came into being at all, was born successfully, it would perish before very long. And the animal's life is one in which the pleasure-pain aspects of his or her life come to terms with each other. They make a settlement between them. The animal's functioning remains confined to that plane of organic existence. But the human has something else emerging out of this. This thing which we call mind, spirit, the transcendent, religion, and so forth, is the thing that is growing out of this animal level, which remains confined to its own plane of the balancing of pleasure-pain. And this growing, which is an outgrowing from that animal stage, is effected through transcending the animal and not rejecting, discarding, suppressing, or hurting the animal. Is it not extraordinarily significant that the Buddha said, he who lives with us, not hurting himself, not hurting others, and he used the word self and others in the commoner garden sense, John Brown, Billy Smith, and so forth, you see, lives with us self, become Brahman, the totality, the all. But to be able not to hurt oneself and not to hurt others means that one has really transcended the travail of the becoming process, of the wheel of becoming. And this transcendence is a case of understanding. And nothing can be understood if any part of that which we try to understand is rejected, or if we put a force against it. The doctor, the psychologist, is concerned with the healing of pain, of sorrow, but remaining at the organic level of separate self-conscious beings. The religious, the man of religion, is concerned with healing through transcending and not remaining stuck fast at that level. If the seed of the Divine Spirit is going to remain everlastingly underground, how will the tree ever come into being? It must outgrow, it must emerge, it must transcend that which it is. Isn't it a curious fact that many a psychologist needs psychologizing and many a doctor needs doctoring? See? For man, real growth anywhere is transcending, emerging into the transcendence, which always means neither accepting nor rejecting. In other words, producing no conflict in the realm of duality. We always feel, yes, that all sounds very nice, but how? What do we actually do in this particular difficulty? Here are two countries at war, here are people suffering, and this, that, and the other. What do we do about it? For one thing, let us recognize that let each one of us recognize that what I myself can do is extremely limited. I can't fly all over the world making paradise for 3,400 million people, obviously. And when we ask the question, what are we going to do? We are asking for an answer which will satisfy our intellectual preconception of what is good and right. This is to deny the unknowability of the living process. We can't predict it. We don't know it. Now, whatsoever happens has at its root consciousness. This is in a sense a dreadful statement to make, because you cannot pinpoint consciousness. But if you look very carefully, if you're really alert to the process of your own life from moment to moment and day to day, you will find that your mental states, your emotional condition, your talking, your physical doing is an expression of your mode of awareness here and now. You will make that discovery. And that mode of awareness is the thing that is invisible. Just as electricity is invisible, we can see its manifestation, light, if and when the current, that energy, that electrical energy is utilized in this particular way. Utilize it in another way, you will get another result. Instead, there are 10, 15, 1,000 different ways in which that energy can express itself. We see the expressions, but we don't see the electricity. The unknown, the transcendent, God, the ultimate, the absolute. This which lies at the very heart of religion, is the actual power out of which emerge these myriad forms which so easily deceive us. Our evaluations, our observations are all mirages, like mirages, because we are unaware of this inward reality, this transcendence. But the awakening to the transcendence is not an awakening to anything that can be pinpointed. When I am awake in this transcendent sense, I don't know that I'm awake. I cannot know it. I cannot hold it. I cannot describe it. I cannot pinpoint it at all. I'm using the word I with reference purely to this particular organism that is speaking. It is the unknown. And it itself is the unknowable. Its effects can be felt by us, can be experienced by us. But when this mystery of awakening does come to fruition, then there is an extraordinary transformation of the whole being. And this thing which is understanding in the religious sense comes to flower. And when it comes to flower, you will find that that one and only thing comes to flower in the various ways we talk about it. Not only understanding love, truth, purity, beauty, in the transcendent sense is there. And because there is the awakening, that which we saw with our mortal eyes as ugly, as horrible, as dreadful, becomes utterly beautiful. Not with a beauty whose criteria are laid down by the intellect or by the conditioned mind. We will see that the pain and the sorrow of life, as well as the pleasure and the joy of life, are all taken up into that condition of complete bliss, which is utterly indescribable. That bliss doesn't move, doesn't show itself in any shape or form. It doesn't merely, as the consolatory religious man would say, comfort you and sustain you. It is something so marvelous that it gives you the power to understand pain and suffering in a totally unsentimental way, in a way which is right beyond intellect. And you know what happens then? The whole being is at peace. When one feels sorrow intensely, where does it break out most in the body? It breaks out here in the solar plexus region and in the throat, doesn't it? All of us, sometime or other in our lives, have restrained our sobs. The intensity of pain which we felt, and where did we feel it? But here and here. You will find that these will be at ease. the region, the visceral region and the solar plexus and the throat, which means that there will be no obstruction to easy rhythmic breathing, which means life. Where one has emerged into some sort of real response in the true sense of the word to the transcendent, where consciousness is transformed, changed, then doing what am I to do, the question, what am I to do, is completely answered. Because whatever you do, in the simple, quiet way, with immediate perception, is the best possible thing to do under the circumstances. Don't seek to evaluate it afterwards. Ah, I wish I had done this. Oh, but I didn't succeed in doing that, and that poor fellow is still suffering, and so forth. Those are all false considerations from the point of view of the transcendent. It's a bad phrase, point of view of the transcendent, but these are the difficulties of language. See, this is why the founders of the great religions and other such spiritual teachers, and there were many through the ages, were called the healers. They were the doctors. A doctor is one who teaches. They were the teachers in that sense. The teacher is he who heals, makes whole. And the making whole does not consist in putting the pieces together and screwing and bolting them. It consists in that transcending, which immediately makes that which was in the state of disharmony into a real harmony. It happens by itself. If I can really look into my hurt of the past and see deeply and truly, this hurt has fulfilled its purpose. As and when it has fulfilled its purpose, the memory will of course remain, unless the particular brain cell or brain cells wherein they are literally, physically locked up, these memories, you see, unless those brain cells are destroyed, in which case the memories go. The memory remains, but the memory is now more like a beautiful fossil displayed in a museum. And you say, how charming it looks, most interesting, most extraordinary. But you yourself are at peace. Don't throw away that fossil, it's useful. When you hear the cry of pain around you, you will know which fossil to refer to in your own little museum. And then you can maintain calm and not lose your balance. You see, isn't it true that when somebody near and dear to us is in pain or suffering, we are all in such a flap that time and again we are more nuisance than help. I had a wonderful demonstration of that. 1962, when my mother died, and a very dear friend of mine, a very young boy, just about 24 or 25, emotional child. He got so upset at hearing the news that he burst out into tears and wept on my shoulder, and I had to console him for the death of my mother. Life is funny, isn't it? I hope we see more and more clearly the tremendous significance of transcendence in the context of religion, and what transcendence does. So now, if we see something of that, then we will really see what the great teachers meant with their teachings. I've mentioned sorrow and the universality of sorrow. The Buddhist dukkha is not just my little misery or your little misery, so to say. It is dukkha, the world travail. And if I see the world travail as this alternation of pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, and their conflict, and all that is involved in that, then I will cease to cling to it. I will naturally cease to get involved, imprisoned by it. And then I will begin to see what the Buddha meant by saying, when he taught mindfulness, when the eye sees an object, not to be entranced by the general appearance thereof or the details, but to see it exactly as it is, an object, to realize that it is impermanent, that it is not the transcendent real, as an object seen by my eye. That is the point. See? And the same with one's feelings, one's thoughts. And now let's come to another important thing. One's beliefs, all the doctrines that one has been taught. We are all conditioned into the mold of doctrines. But if there is any realization, any glimpse of transcendence, we will see that when a doctrine has made its impact on the mind that is observing, and the mind able to extract the essence, the truth underlying that doctrine, then casts aside the doctrine as such. Then that is arriving. You don't cling to it. Otherwise, we cling to the verbal forms and are always misled. Then we go wrong. This is the tragedy of all organized, established, orthodox theologies and churches and so on. The living waters of life are dammed up, and when they stagnate, they merely stink. They are no longer the living waters of life. So no clinging to doctrines, which means, therefore, keeping the mind completely open. Completely open. If the mind is kept completely open, therefore empty, really empty, then the light of the transcendent will shine through unhindered. when all the hurts of the past and all the pleasures of the past will be no more. What they actually are, both the pleasures and the hurts, are like the mud in a stream. When it settles down, there is the pellucid stream, beautiful, lovely, flowing past. Let it flow past. You can select any pleasure of the past and come to the same realization, some intense pleasure. And there is one advantage in considering some intense pleasure, some intense fulfillment, some delight. That intensity is gone forever. And the memory of it makes one cling to the old dead form. And we so glue our eyes onto that dead form that when the dancing delight of life in its freshness, in its virginity is all around me, I am absolutely blind to it. And I cling to this dead form. Albert, shouted Victoria, and remained like that for 10 years, didn't she? At least. You see the tragedy? You see, supposing we have had wonderful fulfillment and happiness in a particular situation. I remember, for instance, in Kashmir, 1934, that was all very wonderful and so forth. Or we may have had wonderful happiness and fulfillment with a person, a friend, a husband, a wife, or whoever it is, you see, and so forth. Then we cling to that memory. You know, clinging to the memory robs one of the inspiration of the living experience. So, let it all go. Just see it as it is. With the mind in equanimity. Be completely free of thinking and feeling in terms of gain and loss. There is nothing which is lost. There is nothing which is gained. That one total reality, which is the supreme, which is the absolute, being and becoming all included in one, is never increased or decreased. It is the totality. So never think in terms of gain and loss, because such calculation is everlastingly, with no possibility of it being otherwise, a miscalculation. It is related to a self-center. That is why. But the whole significance of transcendence is freedom from this self-center. Myself, I want to achieve, I want to express. The meek and mild fellow says, I want to serve God, and the domineering fellow says, I want to attain God, become God. And both are a little bit silly. also look either into a pleasure. And as I said, the advantage of looking into a pleasure is that it will show us how afterwards it is tied up with pain. You see? Or look into what hurt. Look with equanimity and with understanding. And then we will let go the shackles that bind us. We ourselves hold on to the shackles. No one put the shackles on us. It is we who cling to them hard. For dear death, not dear life. Then there is ease, a state of ease. A state of ease in which one has realized the state of humanity. The Son of Man is at last truly the Son of Man. What an extraordinarily, extraordinarily right insight it is which makes the artist paint the Son of Man as the perfectly beautiful one. The Greeks with their Apollo, your European artists with the figure of Christ. I mean, there are other pictures too, and in the suffering Christ too is portrayed. But look at the extraordinary beauty enshrined with love lavished by the artist in the creation of the picture or the statue. That is beauty. That is happiness. One other thing. I mentioned nothing is gained, nothing is lost. One extraordinary change one will observe in oneself that everything, one's own organism, all the functions of the body, the functions of the mind, the world around us, the objects, all the teachings, the ideas, all our philosophies, our perceptions, with regard to what we call the unmanifest, the indestructible, etc., they will all get taken up into this vast unknown, the Absolute, which they called Brahman, Atma, Eckhart's Godhead. Oh, God of the great theologians who understood what they meant by the word God. They were rather few. To all be taken up into that. A great philosopher like Spinoza, for instance, saw into that. You will find it in his Ethics. He's put it in a rather dry intellectualist form. And there are limitations present in the form, but it looks as if he did penetrate and see. Everything will be taken up into that ultimate absolute. And you yourself will be aware of it. You'll be awake to it. And in that awakened state, there will be no conflict. There will be no interfering with the stream of becoming. Because one will have left behind, as a thing of the past, this separative self-consciousness, I am I. and all self-orientation will have vanished, and there will only be the one reality.